You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Okay, let me just get started by welcoming all of you here this afternoon. I'm very delighted about this wonderful turnout. My name is Liane Schalatek. I'm the Associate Director of the Heinrich Böll Foundation here in Washington, D.C. The Heinrich Böll Foundation, for those of you who don't know it, is a German political party foundation affiliated with the Green Party in Germany and has been working on sustainable development, including agricultural policy alternatives, gender equity, climate change, and a variety of other issues that have come in the last couple of years really to the forefront of the policy debate. So we are particularly pleased to be able to co-host the event here with the Carnegie Endowment and Sandra Pulaski's program on trade equity and development. And I really want to give thanks for Sandra to be willing to jump at that opportunity here and have the discussion here with us, because very often in Washington, D.C., policy dialogues, particularly quote-unquote the more official side, a lot of the policy alternatives that have come up on various issues have been neglected, and it has been our work and our intention to make sure that there is a podium of some of those very substantial policy alternative proposals and suggestions. Now, I don't have to tell you why the debate today is such a current one. Obviously, this weekend we have the annual meeting of IMF and World Bank, where the global food crisis is going to be one of the major issues on the Development Committee agenda. Although, and we have to be quite honest about that, it might be overshadowed somewhat by the global financial crisis and the tendency, particularly of some of the industrialized countries, to focus a lot on themselves. However, I think we have to be quite honest in acknowledging the need to think, to link those two crises and to think those two crises together, and with that to really rethink policy responses to both of these crises. From my understanding and from the understanding of a lot of thinkers that have dealt with the issues more substantively than I could, we are really at a crossroads of our understanding of markets, market failures, government role in regulating markets or guiding markets, particularly as it pertains to the benefits of human development and global goods, and that includes obviously environmental integrity and sustainability, all those issues that play an important role in any discussion about agriculture. And this will come out in our discussion as well. It's not so far-fetched to link the global financial crisis to the global food crisis, as commodity price speculation definitely has been one of the accompanying factors or one of the inputs to the global food crisis. So with the fact that we are at a crossroad, with the fact that we are at a crisis moment, and hopefully are able to go beyond a panic and into some clear thinking, I think it is an opportunity to really rethink and not march brave on as so far as business as usual, the policy response and the global community's response to some of the issues that we are discussing here today. So with that, let me introduce a wonderful panel. Again, one of our reason for the discussion here was really that we felt that some of the policy alternative proposals, globally developed, multi-stakeholder dialogues, really innovative thinking from civil society organizations isn't necessarily always giving that that limelight that we, thanks to C-SPAN, are enjoying today. So we will, as part of the discussion, focus particularly on two proposals that have come forward, one via the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development, IAASTD, and then also, and that's obviously the privilege if you are in the have the good fortune to organize event, one of the proposals that has been developed with the participation of the Heinrich Böll Foundation, the Ecofair Trade Dialogue, and some of the recommendations that have come out of that. So again, we have a wonderful panel. I'll introduce them briefly right now, and then we have all of them speak for about 10 minutes, which, if I'm succeeding in my timekeeping role, should give us about 45 minutes to an hour in varying degrees for hopefully a stimulating discussion. We will start with Sandra Pulaski, who's sitting here to my immediate left, your right, who is the director of the Trade, Equity, and Development Program and a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. I don't really have to introduce her in Washington, D.C., but probably for a more global U.S., for a more wider U.S. audience. Her work focuses on trade, development, and employment policies, and she has served in a variety of capacities, among others, as the Special Representative for International Labor Affairs, as the U.S. Secretary of State, and she has also worked as the Director for Economic and Legal Research at the Secretariat for the North American Commission for Labor Cooperation, which is a NAFTA-related intergovernmental organization. And Sandra will give us a broader overview over some of the issues before we are then continuing on with Steve Sapan. He's the second from your right. Steve will give us an overview over the global synthesis report of the International Assessment of Agricultural Knowledge, Science, and Technology for Development. Steve is a senior policy analyst at the Institute for Agriculture and Trade Policy, which is based in Minneapolis. And much of Steve's work in the past has focused, and I guess it keeps him busy and probably up at night, to explain U.S. agriculture, trade, and food safety policy to foreign governments and non-governmental organizations, especially farmer organizations. And we will hear a lot about those connections today. He holds a PhD in comparative literature and studied philosophy at the University of Vienna. Next to him on his immediate right is Simplice Davo-Vodoue, and we are very pleased that Davo made the very wide trip from Benin to join us here for the discussion and that it worked out with the visa regulations, because we think it's really important to have a voice recounting the immediate impact on the ground in Africa, how it affects people there and livelihoods there. Simplice is the head of the Department of Agricultural Economics, and the coordinator of the Organisation Béninoise pour la Promotion de l'Agriculture Biologique. And as that, he is also a member of the steering committee of the Pesticide Action Network in Africa, has been working on rural development for many years before joining the university where he's teaching agricultural extension. Then, next to Sandra Pulaski, is Daniel De La Torre Ugarte, who is a professor and associate director at the Agricultural Policy and Analysis Center at the University of Tennessee. Danielle has been working with the Heinrich Böll Foundation over the course of the last couple of years on the process on agricultural policy alternatives, the Ecofair Trade, Global Trade Dialogue, and in that capacity, he's going to present some of the work that has been done, an implementation paper dealing with food crisis and commodity prices. And last but not least, and we are very grateful for Stephen to make his appearance here possible, seeing that there are a variety of agricultural policy dialogues and seminars going on as part of the IMF annual meeting just those next couple of days. And the rural development and agricultural department must be one of the most in demand during those couple of days. Steven Schoenberger is going to be our last speaker. He's a lead operations officer for rural development in the East Asia and Pacific region of the World Bank, has worked on agricultural and rural development issues in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And in addition, he's also, as far as I understand, the focal point, the intermediary liaison of the World Bank to the UN Food Crisis Committee at the moment. So with that, I give the word to Sandra for about 10 minutes, and hopefully we have a great discussion.
Thank you, Leanne, and let me also welcome all of you to Carnegie on behalf of the Carnegie Endowment. We have a wonderful group today looking over the participant list. I know that many of you are experts on various aspects of this topic, so we're looking forward to a very rich discussion. As Leanne said, I want to frame the issues by looking at some of the most important underlying factors giving rise to the food crisis, those that have particular relevance to development, poverty, and hunger, because that is the focus of our discussion today, as opposed to factors that might affect more wealthy countries and consumers who are under less stress than in developing countries. And I want to group these factors into two broad categories, because sometimes we make very long lists and don't see the relationships. First is the question of underinvestment in developing country agriculture, and I'll talk more about that in a moment, a problem that has really developed over the last 30 years. And second, I want to talk about a range of market imperfections that affect the agricultural sector, several different ones, and I'll go into them in detail. Starting with the question of underinvestment in developing country agriculture, we need to step back and remember that historically the way countries develop is that they, if they develop, they proceed through a virtuous circle from where every country has started in history, which is agriculture. They proceed through a circle of more investment in agriculture, increasing productivity in agriculture that gradually raises incomes of farmers, which allows them to make more investment, which makes their productivity increase more, which makes them less poor. They're able to buy more things. And this reinforcing circle has been the way that countries have been able to accumulate a surplus. From going from societies where there was only production for consumption to having a surplus, this was the basis. This growth in the agricultural sector was a basis for the accumulation of capital and the basis for increased domestic demand, which could then consume the products that were produced in other sectors as the economies began to diversify. So as I'm saying, this process allowed for investment, both investment and consumption in other sectors of economy, usually beginning with simple manufactured goods and simple services and leading to increasing diversification over time. If we look at the long picture of development, this was the pattern that we saw in the West, beginning in Europe and then moving on to the countries of the so-called New World, in Latin America, in the U.S., in Australia, and so on. This was the pattern that we saw in those countries in the 18th and 19th centuries. And in the 20th century, this is the pattern of development that we saw take hold in Asia as well, beginning with Japan and then Korea, and moving more recently to China. Unfortunately, countries that are still poor today that are based primarily in agriculture, and this certainly includes almost all of the least developed countries in the world, and probably another 20 or 25 additional countries that have 70, 75, 85% of their population still engaged in very low productivity agriculture, those countries have not gotten on to that path yet. They haven't gone on to that proven development path that I was just talking about that helped all of the richer countries eventually develop and diversify. They turned away from that strategy and adopted strategies that were inappropriate to their stage of development. And in a nutshell, what those strategies were first, export-oriented development, the idea that they should specialize in high-value export agriculture as opposed to investing and growing in their own production of food and things that could be consumed and where they could gradually accumulate surplus, but rather they were encouraged to go into high-value export agriculture and export-oriented manufactured goods, particularly low-skill, high-labor-intensity, low-labor-skilled goods, the export-oriented development strategy. And that meant that there was a hole in those countries in the emphasis on food for production and this traditional strategy I talked about. But the solution in this unproven and inappropriate development strategy, which has been very common for the last 30 years, was that those countries would simply import food from global markets. And as all of you know, prices were at historical lows for much of the last 30 years, up until a couple of years ago. And so the fact that the countries could buy food from global markets at low prices simply reinforced the propensity of some countries to adopt this strategy. Now, this strategy was justified by many actors. I mentioned in the slide the World Bank, the IMF, donors. It certainly was pushed by the U.S. Agency for International Development, DFID, others. It was embraced or reluctantly accepted by a number of national governments, including in those least developed countries. And again, it was based on the low global food prices, and in many cases it was pushed by the international financial institutions because of the need of those countries to gain foreign exchange after the debt crises of the 1980s. However, this strategy was based on a flawed analysis. One of the flaws of that analysis was what's called the fallacy of composition, which basically says that a policy that may be good for one country or one actor, if it is adopted by all, cannot work for all. It can only work for a subset. And so the fallacy of composition was that if developing countries all go into export agriculture, they will all make money. Well, many of them went into coffee 15 years ago, and the coffee market collapsed. More recently, into cut flowers, and those prices have been declining very dramatically. On the manufactured side, it's evident in apparel, where the prices of apparel have been dropping for the last 10 or 15 years. So countries were going into markets that, by that very fact that this strategy was being propagated around the world, were becoming overcrowded with overcapacity, overproduction, and falling prices. Second, this strategy ignored the distortionary effects of subsidies and agricultural protection and protection of some of those labor-intensive manufacturing industries as well in wealthy countries. So the markets that countries were selling into were not always available to them, or they were selling at prices which were distorted by subsidies. An additional strategy, flaw in the analysis, was the fact that for many foods, rice is an example, global markets are very thin, and there was actually not enough being produced if all countries, again, by fallacy of composition, decided they wanted to buy their rice, or many countries, there was not enough production to feed them. So we have a flawed strategy. We have 30 years of failure to invest in agriculture by the developing countries themselves, the ones that have failed to succeed, and by the donors. 30 years ago, 18% of official development assistance, that would be money from the World Bank and from USAID and the other donors to agriculture, constituted 18% of their total contributions of development assistance. And now it's only 3%. As a result, we have a situation where many developing countries with surplus arable land and with surplus unskilled labor are today net food importers. This is bad for them. It's bad for their poor. They have to buy at high prices what they could produce themselves when they're underemployed and need employment, need sources of livelihoods. It's bad for their balance of payments. And it's also harmful to the entire world community because it reduces the amount of food production, thereby reducing the global food supply. This problem of neglect of the agricultural sector in developing countries was compounded by the market imperfections that characterize agriculture globally and frankly, have characterized it for a very long time. I'm just going to touch on them lightly because I want to save some time to draw some preliminary conclusions. Financial markets. Leanne mentioned the question of speculation in commodities markets, and I would argue that speculation per se, short-term movements to short-term investments to try to take advantage of movements in prices is one part of it, but it's broader than that. It's not just the speculators. It's those going into commodities futures markets for long-term investments. We saw a lot of pension funds, equity funds, hedge funds taking up very large positions in commodities futures because it looked like a place where you could make a lot of money, above average returns, just like one time the tech sector looked that way and later the U.S. housing market looked that way. Well, more recently the agriculture futures markets looked that way. And so far from being speculators, the buy and hold position rushed money into those markets, and so we got, as you would expect, an asset bubble. Too many dollars chasing too few goods. We get overshooting of markets, et cetera. The current financial crisis, if anything, is likely to exaggerate these effects in agricultural markets, including in agricultural land prices, which we see ping-ponging around the world, in some places going up and other places going down based on financial market expectations of future returns. And all of this, at a minimum, is likely to seriously increase the volatility in food markets in the future. Other market Imperfections abound. Concentration at the global level in some grain markets and in some inputs markets, whether it's seeds, fertilizer, et cetera. We have domination by a few firms and oligarchies, and so they can engage in strategic behavior where they manipulate prices in order to gain market share, to induce dependency, whatever. We also have market failures within the developing countries themselves, sometimes because of market concentration. Very often the intermediaries don't have competition. There's asymmetrical bargaining power and knowledge and capacity, particularly in some of the least developed countries where the collectors of food products, the intermediaries, can pass on price declines because of their market position. However, they don't necessarily pass on price increases to farmers. And also there are failures in the availability of credit to small farmers as well. What are the policy implications of these two broad sets of problems, market failures and failure to invest in agriculture? First is a very basic point that countries at early stages of structural transformation or the transition from agriculture to other sectors, that is, these many, many countries, particularly in Africa and a few other parts of the world that have 70, 80, 90% of their population in agriculture, should be encouraged to produce food for domestic and for regional consumption. Investment should be made a priority of the donors and the national governments. As I said, some of the national governments who adopted these policies were willing participants. Others were forced as conditionalities of loans and grants from donors. However, for the countries themselves and for the donors, investment in agriculture, including building irrigation, roads to market, extension services, research, credit to small farmers, all of this has to be made a high priority. Beyond this, the developing country governments themselves have to create the policy tools to address these agricultural market imperfections in their own markets. Obviously, they can't influence global markets, but they can control at the country level through such things as regulation of intermediaries. In countries with large numbers of small-scale farmers and only a few marketers who are taking those goods to market, those marketers either have to be regulated by government so that you don't get distortionary behavior, or the governments themselves might have to take up a role in marketing, which has been done rather successfully in a number of countries that have succeeded in getting themselves on this virtuous development path. At the most fundamental level, developing country governments have to ensure adequate remuneration for their farmers. If farmers can't make money, a small profit on the goods that they plant and sell, the subsistence farmers will only produce for themselves. They can't afford to buy from anyone else. They'll produce for themselves, but they won't expand their production. We won't get more of a supply response if governments can't ensure adequate remuneration. This means that governments have to take measures to secure a minimum price that farmers know at the beginning of the season they'll receive at the end of the season. This is something that has gone out of fashion many places. However, the countries that have maintained these kinds of policies, like India, have actually weathered this crisis reasonably well, and I think at the end of the period of time, we're actually going to see that there was progress on poverty alleviation in such countries. We have to recognize that for some low-income countries who don't have large diversified economies, who don't have budgetary resources to themselves guarantee minimum support prices, the only tools they may have may be trade tools. For example, tariffs or barriers to entry may be the only ways that some governments can actually ensure these remunerative levels of prices for their farmers in order to elicit more production. And these are questions that are under debate right now. I would have said hot debate 2 months ago when they were actively being negotiated in the Doha round. That may be on the back burner for a year or two. But the Doha round collapsed specifically over questions of a special safeguard mechanism that developing countries could use to shield their farmers from drops in prices and surges of imports that would put their small farmers out of business. Whatever policy regimes we come up with, today's trade policy regimes must leave adequate space for developing countries to be able to use the agricultural sector as an engine for development, just as we did in the United States, just as Europe did, and just as Asia and China did before us. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Sandra. And I'm pretty sure that some of our later speakers will pick up on some of the issues, particularly the issue of underinvestment in developing country agriculture, as well as the market imperfections and the need to not necessarily make sure that we are returning to a low-price policy for agricultural commodities, but to a fair-price policy for agricultural commodities. With that, I would like to pass the word on to Steve Supan, who will give us an overview over the IAA-STD global report. Again, that was a multi-stakeholder process. And I think particularly looking at some of the challenges that we are facing, and, for example, we have to think agriculture in synthesis and in connection with the climate change crisis that we are also facing, it becomes more and more important to think through what role knowledge, science, and technology can play or should play to ensure that we are finding the right development answers for agriculture. Steve, please.
Thank you, Leanne, and thank you to the Bull Foundation, to Carnegie, the Carnegie Endowment for inviting the IAA-STD to give an overview of the process and a quick summary of a few of the themes in the synthetic report. The IAA-STD was approved, or I should say the synthetic report was approved by 58 governments on April 12, 2008 in Johannesburg. The United States, Australia, and Canada were the only governments who did not approve of the synthesis report, which is about 100 pages long. The IAA-STD itself consists of a global report and five sub-global reports, each about 500 to 550 pages long, that will be published between the end of November and the end of December. It's important to understand very briefly the process of the IAA-STD because this is very much a negotiated text. So it's not like reading the product of a FAO staff report or even an academic series of articles. There were two rounds of external reviews to which more than 400 authors had to respond in great detail. And so the amount of literature reviewed, quite frankly, was sometimes overwhelming. The IAA-STD had three main goals concerning development and sustainability, and those were to reduce hunger and poverty, to improve rural livelihoods, human health and nutrition, and to promote equitable, socially, environmentally, and economically sustainable development, especially for the 2.6 billion people in the world who rely on agriculture for some part of their livelihood. And this includes crops, livestock, forestry, and fishing. Very briefly, what the IAA-STD is not. It is not an entity. It is not a funded project like the World Bank's New Deal for Global Agriculture. IAA-STD really much depends on being able to articulate its ideas to governments, to civil society organizations. Basically, it is a project in search of investment. And the approach, because of the time frame and the terms of reference, was not to look at the food crisis from the last 40 days, the next 40 days, but really to look at it from the last 40 years and the next 40 years. So most of the IAA-STD was finished by the end of 2007. So the kind of food financial crisis factors, the commodity index funds and the loss of risk management capacity for both agribusiness and for farmers is not a topic that it's dealt with explicitly in the IAA-STD. The synthetic report has eight topics, three of which I'll talk about today. The eight are bioenergy, biotechnologies, climate change, human health, natural resource management, trade and markets, traditional and local knowledge and community-based innovation, and last but not least, women in agriculture. And so I'll just be talking about the climate change cross-cutting topic, human health, and women in agriculture. And, of course, I'd be happy to discuss the findings of the other themes during the Q&A. So according to the IAA-STD calculations, which are partially based on the International Panel on Climate Change fourth report, agriculture conservatively contributes to about 30% of greenhouse gas emissions that are causing the very extreme weather events that have affected forms of agricultural production, food security, and ecosystem function. For example, the European heat wave the summer of 2003 decreased maize yields by about 20%. The IASCD approach to climate change, not just to climate change, but to agriculture generally, is multifunctional. The traditional business as usual approach is to invest in agriculture to maximize yields. And this business as usual model has to externalize all manner of environmental and social costs to give the appearance of being efficient, particularly for trade. The IASTD instead assumes that agricultural policy should produce not just commodities, but rural employment, household food security, environmental goods and services, public health benefits, and other functions that require appropriate policy planning and investments. The greenhouse gas emissions must be reduced very sharply and soon. At the present rate of greenhouse gas emissions by 2050, global warming is projected to force the migration of 200 million people a year. The formal, to kind of a shorthand, the university form of agricultural knowledge, science, and technology technology transfer has been directed at input and energy-intensive irrigated monocropping systems that have contributed to increased greenhouse gas emissions. And so one of the things that the IASTD suggests is that there needs to be a greater employment of social scientists and of traditional knowledge specialists in the planning and investment of agriculture targeted to reduce these greenhouse gas reductions and to also to adapt to climate change. The IASTD also suggests that after 2012 that the Framework Convention on Climate Change should take advantage of agricultural knowledge, science and technology options for adaption and mitigation of the effects of climate change. For example, at the upcoming meeting in Poland of the Framework Convention, there should be a reorientation of the Clean Development Mechanism to be able to take into account the agricultural effects of climate change and to assign investment funds specifically for mitigation and adaptation. On the human health front, as you know, the FAO has recently added 75 million people to the already 850 million who it defines as undernourished and food insecure. Despite the increase in global food production, global undernutrition remains a major public health issue, causing perhaps 15% of all disease as of the year 2000. While there is considerable efficiency in the agricultural system in providing calories and proteins, only about 66% of the global population gets adequate minerals, vitamins, and other micronutrients. There is an agricultural policy that basically supports the creation of monoculture crops, especially feed crops for dairy and meat, the meat trade, and very little support, relatively speaking, for nutrient-dense grains, vegetables, and fruits. So there needs to be a strategy to reverse the not just undernutrition, but the devastating effects of diet-related chronic disease, including diabetes, health, heart attacks, and cancer that are related to this intensive production of fats, refined sugars, and empty calories. Foodborne disease is now causing about 12 to 13 million child deaths a year. About 75% of emerging diseases are transmitted from animals to humans, partly due to the intensification of livestock production and partly due to the ineffective enforcement of food safety and animal health measures. There is relatively little global coordination to try to deal with these epizootic diseases. The Codex Alimentarius Commission and the World Animal Health Organization have just started to really work intensely on this issue. The funding, unfortunately, for mitigation of food safety contagions is largely something that's done ad hoc on a voluntary fund basis, and there needs to be a permanent fund to deal with those issues. Finally, women in agriculture. Women form about 20 to 70% of the agricultural and post-harvest workforce in developing countries. They produce about 75% of global food production, even though what investment focuses on, indeed what the multilateral institutions have focused on, is a much smaller percentage of food, which is traded internationally. Due to the increasing rates of rural out-migration caused by the policy failures that Sandra Pawlowski has outlined, female farmers and agricultural workers are assuming greater and greater burdens for food production, indigenous plant breeding, and rural entrepreneurship, but they don't have access to the resources that they need to really take on these responsibilities. Furthermore, there's a feminization of agriculture, particularly in the horticulture and floriculture industries, that are basically designed to provide cheap labor with no benefits. Women traditionally perform manual tasks, but they are now being asked to also spray pesticides and operate machinery, often without adequate training, which endangers their health. So to meet the IASTD sustainability and development goals, agricultural knowledge, science, and technology needs to be targeted to support women's roles in agriculture. This can include a wider range of knowledge and technologies, and policies for enabling environment, including water rights, land title, input credit, marketing program assistance, communication technology assistance, and market evaluation. Kind of the bottom line on this particular topic is that, given the huge and growing responsibility of women for household food security and small-scale natural resource management, without these supporting programs corresponding to these responsibilities, IASTD sustainability and development goals cannot be achieved. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Steve. I think some of the points that Steve has pointed out are important as we are carrying the discussion forward, and I would point out just one of them, namely the fact that we can't go on with agricultural policies as previously without internalizing environmental and social costs, and that we need to really look at policy approaches that go beyond, be it in the face of a climate crisis, be it in the face of the energy crisis that we are all facing, need to go beyond energy-intensive and irrigated monocropping systems. And lastly, I want to thank Steve specifically for pointing out the fact that is often forgotten and particularly not always picked up by the donor community as well, that agriculture and food policies has gender-differentiated impact, and that investment schemes, and we will hear later on about some of the World Bank food programs, one, the Global Crisis Response Program, but also the vision that World Bank President Sirleaf has outlined for a new deal of global agriculture, global food policy, whether that takes into account some of those gender-differentiated policy impact, and we would hope that it does. So now I'm going to give the word to Simplice, and Simplice has also worked on the IASTD larger overall endeavor. And you can already see from the presentation that Steve gave that it really is a worthwhile endeavor and is worth reading. I want to point out that there is a 24-page summary available of the larger global report, because I think certainly nobody who is in Washington, D.C. will have time to read through several 550-pages report, wonderfully written they might be. But there is a very accessible 24-page summary, and it can be looked up in multiple languages at www.ecassessment.org, and I would just encourage you to take a look at that. So that gave Davo enough time to switch places, and now we'll hear from him. Davo, again, has worked on the Sub-Sahara report of IAASTD, and, you know, the food crisis obviously has the most significant effect on the poorest people in the poorest country, and unfortunately, sub-Saharan Africa is then the region that is probably hit the most, and we are looking forward to Davos' recommendations.
I would like briefly give some contribution with respect to how we, from sub-Saharan Africa, we see the international assessment and what is the specificity of that assessment. And I would like from the beginning telling you that I'm more used to speak French than English, so I will go very slowly. Okay, I think that Steve has extensively talked about what the international assessment was, but I would like to focus on a few points, mainly about the sponsors. Many sponsors are involved in that assessment. It is not only one sponsor who decides to make that assessment with its viewpoint. You have here many, many sponsors: FAO, Global Environment Facilities, United Development Program, United Nations Environment Program, UNEP, United Nations Education, Scientific and Cultural Organization, UNESCO, and the World Bank and World Health Organization. All those organizations contribute to the assessment, and that means that the results are not results reflecting only one point of view, but from all those organizations. And what was the central question addressed by the international assessment? What must we do differently to overcome persistent poverty and hunger, achieve equitable and sustainable development, and sustain productive and a relying environment? That was one of the central questions we addressed. And from African point of view, we try to combine different strategies to come to a conclusion. How has the international assessment worked? And I think that Steve raised a number of questions, but I would like to say that that assessment was viewed as very independent from any donors and independent from institution. And it is a multi-stakeholder approach, involving NGOs, industries, academicians, government. All those people are involved as equal partners, not anyone dominating the others. And this is very important that I have to stress it. And it is also a multidisciplinary process. Different disciplines have been called upon this process. And also, people respect divergence between people. If you bring your point of view, people should respect it. And people should discuss about it and to find some consensus. If there is no consensus, we have to mention it. And the scale of the challenge of covering a broad range of complex issues.
Sorry, really briefly, we can hear a lot of BlackBerries rattling away, and that obviously interferes with the transmission. So if you have your BlackBerry on at the moment, either take it outside or turn it off, please.
So, thank you. And the concept of the international assessments was endorsed as a multi-thematic, multi-spatial, multi-temporal, and intergovernmental processes with multi-stakeholder bureau co-sponsored by the same organization I have just mentioned. And how is the international assessment is managed? It is also equal. We have 30 government and 30 civil society represented in the bureau. And as mentioned by Steve, about 400 of the world's experts were selected to prepare the report. These experts worked in their own capacity and did not represent any particular stakeholder group. Additional individuals, organizations, and government were involved in the peer review process. What are the main results? There are diverse and conflicting interpretations of past and current events which need to be acknowledged and respected. Agriculture involves more than yield. It has multiple social, political, cultural, and environmental impact and benefit. That is the multifunctionality of agriculture. Usually, people think that it is only a product, but it is a multifunction. For example, you will see in areas in Africa, people continue to grow some crops, some specific species, not just to have something to eat, but for some cultural thing. Because the yield is very low, and you may say, why are you producing those kind of crops? This have some social impact in the area, and where you could do everything, they won't stop growing such kind of crop. The future of agriculture lies in agroecological farming and triple bottom line business practices that meet social, environmental, and economic goals. And there is a reliance on resource extractive. Industrial agriculture is dangerous and unsustainable. Short-term technical fixes do not address complex challenges and often exacerbate social and environmental harm. Achieving food security and sustainable livelihood of poor people in chronic poverty depend on ensuring access to and control of resources by small-scale farmers, because we have more small-scale farmers than industrial farmers in our localities. Fair local, regional, and global trading regime can build local economies, reduce poverty, and improve livelihood. Strengthening the human and ecological reliance on the agricultural system improve our capacity to respond to changing environmental and social stresses. Indigenous knowledge and community-based innovation are an invaluable part of the solution. Good decision-making requires building better governmental mechanisms and ensuring democratic participation by the full range of people. And as a conclusion, I would like to say that the compelling option for confronting the food crisis by strengthening farmers' organizations, creating more equitable, transparent trade agreements, increasing local participation in policy formation and other decision-making processes, then we can begin to reverse structural inequities within and between countries, increase rural communities' access to and control over resources, and pave the way toward local and national food sovereignties. And the international assessment concludes that ensuring food security and recognizing food sovereignty necessitates ending the institutional marginalization of the world's small-scale producers. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Davo. I hope that in the discussion we'll have some opportunity maybe to get some very concrete sub-Saharan examples and hope that can be raised. Davo introduced a couple of key concepts that I'm pretty sure that our next speaker is going to pick up upon. He mentioned the multifunctionality of agriculture and what he called the triple bottom line, namely the fact that you have to include social, environmental, as well as economic considerations when devising policy strategies in agriculture. And he also included and pointed out what we haven't heard so far, the need for democratic participation and the need for democratic considerations in both agricultural policy development, policy implementation, and that obviously needs to include or needs to make sure that the voices of small-scale farmers are heard as well and that they are given some control and access to resources. With that, I would like to turn it over to Daniel De La Torre Ugarte, who will give us, and I know he will be challenged by that, but I'll try to keep a tight watch on time, an implementation paper that has been part of the Heinrich Böll Foundation and Miserio Ecofair agricultural trade process, looking at what opportunities are created by the global food crisis for alternative policy suggestions in agriculture. Please, Daniel.
Thank you very much, Leanne, and thank you very much to the Heinrich Böll Foundation and the Carnegie Endowment for inviting me to this, to share with you these ideas that the Ecofair Trade Dialogue has put forward. What I want to, what you're going to see is that I'm going to not repeat necessarily, but take some of the concepts that are, have already put, but some of the speakers, and try to put it in one direction that clearly points to the recommendations that at the end we put forward in this paper. We have already heard a lot about what is going on what is the food crisis data and so forth. So more than that, I'm going to emphasize in some of the key concepts. The most important thing that I want to bring back together, although everybody probably in the room knows about it, but it is necessary to be emphasized once and every time that we speak, which is the role that agriculture plays in terms of poverty reduction and food security. The developing world, almost half of the people have their livelihoods directly or indirectly linked to agriculture. Of those 2.5 billion people, 1.5 billion people are in small households, smallholder households. There are 800 million people food insecure. Probably today we are talking about 900. Of those, 80% are in rural areas, okay? Poverty in agriculture, rural areas. In many developing countries, still agriculture reaches more than 50%, generates more than 50% of employment and more than 25% of the GDP. And as reported in the, all of these data as reported in the World Development Report from last year. And the report also emphasizes as an idea that we have lost somehow in the last 10 or 15 years, that an increase in 1% of GDP in agriculture is much more efficient in reducing poverty than any other sector of the economy. All of this is in the World Bank Development Report. And I think that we have to reemphasize and put forward what is the importance that agriculture has in this area. Everybody for the last year and a half has been focused on the food prices, and some people have been emphasizing weather, China, India, and so forth. But after a specific analysis, one have to come to the conclusion that this crisis is human made, and is a result to a large extent of poor policy choices. Some of those are, for example, the elimination of public stockholding in the U.S. and in other countries, failure to invest in agriculture in the last 20 to 30 years, and therefore to support local farmers and encourage local food production, failure to protect ecosystems, and a huge push for government deregulation. All of these are human-made actions. Now, why did prices rise? But before talking about what triggered the spike in prices, what I want to talk is what was the performance of the agricultural sector before the prices increase, okay? First of all, after decades of low agricultural prices, rural incomes have been totally depressed. And investment in the agricultural sector, public and private, has been discouraged. Second, we have reached in the last 10 years a point in which low prices cannot generate significant increases in food security. The current structure of agriculture doesn't hold anymore to keep adding gains to food security. As we have heard, in terms of environmental component, 30% of the greenhouse gases are either linked to agriculture or to forest land. That means that either agricultural practices or consumption or our consumption diet is contributing next to fossil fuels to be the second emitter of greenhouse gases. This is the performance of agriculture. This is the performance of the dominant agricultural system, industrial agriculture, that we had before the prices spiked. My conclusion should be, our conclusion should be, our goal cannot be to go back to 2005. Our conclusion has to be, what can we move forward and take advantage of this situation in order to change the dynamics that we had before 2005? We already have heard about the issues that trigger these price spikes, the rapid increase in biofuels, and it's just that biofuels increase in three years, the use of biofuels increase almost the same amount that it took about 12 years to increase the feed demand. So it's just the speed at which biofuels increase. You have heard the low level of stocks, the deregulation of the U.S. commodity futures. This is especially important because there was legislation that limited the participation of index commodity funds, speculative funds, to 11 million bushels in every single position for a speculator. Only the two biggest speculators or the two biggest index funds hold today or after a few weeks ago 2 billion bushels of grains, which is basically 80% of the total grains that we use in the U.S. for ethanol. So it's a huge demand. The impact of China and India and weather have been totally overestimated and exaggerated. Now, obviously, higher prices are going to affect consumers negatively, but at the same time, higher prices have the potential to generate significant income in those 2.5 billion people. Now, is this automatic? No, it's not automatic. We have case after case in which most of the price increases that we have seen in the last few months have not reached rural areas, have not reached producers, and therefore just puts into question whether the current structure can really transfer those price gains to the rural areas in order to create a new dynamic in the agricultural sector. I don't think in this stage of development in pursuing the same model of agricultural development that we are pursuing in the last 20 to 30 years, we are going to be able to dramatically affect that equation without significant changes. Now, this is where our contribution comes in terms of potential avenues that we may be able to use in order to take advantage of these high agricultural prices. High agricultural prices mean that there is an unmet demand, and there is a possibility if those prices, and I'm not saying the 300s or the 900s or the $150 corn, but just prices higher enough than the ones we have experienced the last 30 years, higher than those, have the opportunity to bring investment into agriculture, public and private. And that is an opportunity that we cannot miss. However, it matters what kind of investment. If we don't do anything, what we are going to see is that we are going to have huge amount of investment in displacing land use, huge amount of investment in emphasizing and increasing the intensive use of those inputs that are contributing to the greenhouse gas impacts, to the degradation of the soil, and to the perpetuation of the industrial model. So it matters what do we do. And the goal of what we do has to be poverty reduction, increase food security, and enhance environmental performance. How can we create, how can we move to an agricultural sector that provides a balanced development in those three elements? And there are actions that are short-term actions and actions of longer term, not that can be taken later, but that it takes longer time for them to mature. But both of them, both of these sets, need to be done yesterday. We have looked to a smarter production and use of biofuels, which basically means we have to keep the increase in the use of biofuels at the level in which we develop our productive capacity in agriculture. Biofuels cannot be going three times as fast as we are developing our productive agriculture. In that regard, there are two actions that can be taken. One, the U.S. and the EU could slow down the pace of growth. And on the other hand, bring into the picture ethanol made from sugar in order to reduce the pressure on food commodities. Another action of immediate use, more and better humanitarian aid, goes without any more clarification. We have to regulate commodity exchanges, go back to the limits that we can, in which speculators can hold speculative positions in agricultural commodities. And the domestic policy space has to come before trade policy objectives. Actions of mid or longer term impact. The national objective has to be, a national objective has to be developed in which more sustainable agricultural production should be the guideline for the development of a new agriculture. And that basically means that we have to start bringing into the farmer's balance sheet and the sector's balance sheet the environmental cost. We have to invest in infrastructure. If if we want farmers to receive a higher share of the price, we have to increase the efficiency of the marketing system through better roads, better infrastructure of distribution, and more alternative channels of distribution. We have to invest in production capacity. And production capacity means technology, technology that goes directly associated with the resources that the country or the region has, and also the potential utilization of that foodstuff in a more local-based diet. Invest in institutions. We have to democratize access to land, water, credit, and policy making. Again, we have to reform a multilateral trade system in which the bad word is not distortion, but the objective is distort the market in the right direction. Distort the market to generate more developing in developing countries, reduce poverty, and increase food security. We have to, if we don't do it now, when? We have to reestablish food green reserves, either locally or internationally. It doesn't matter if we hold a certificate of a virtual reserve, if we don't have the volume and the physical availability of those commodities. So a physical grain reserve has to be a part of any solution. And in terms of an agricultural and energy policy, what we have to bring in the table again is the fact that, one, we need biofuels in the sense that is going to be the demand that is going to keep these prices from going back to what we have in the last 30 years. But at the same time, have a smarter policy in which we look at the right feedstock, we look at the local use as the primary use, and we premium, we give a premium for environmental and rural development performance. We cannot afford to go back to the pre-crisis agriculture. If nothing is done, we are going to miss this opportunity for poverty reduction, agricultural, and climate change. The priorities have to be production and consumption of local crops, invest in production capacity, and revalue smallholders and rural development. We have to introduce environmental costs in producers' balance sheet. Domestic food policy objectives have to come before trade objectives. And at the same time, we have to be prepared for lower prices. Thank you.
Thanks so much. And last but not least, and as you can tell, all of our speakers would have plenty more to say, and I just want to point out that we have some written documents that are available to all of you that point out some of the points and the arguments that the speakers are presenting here in greater detail, and we are almost necessarily doing them injustice here by having to cut them short. But nevertheless, we have the documents. I would encourage you to read up on that. And now we are looking very much forward to hearing the thoughts of Stephen Schoenberger from the World Bank. The World Bank, lots of the topics that have come up here have been addressed in the World Development Report on Agriculture, which was published last year and which some of the speakers referred to. And now I guess the World Bank, having... some would say not very nicely, rediscovered agriculture after an absence of several decades, is really at the forefront on helping formulate or trying to push forward for a newer global deal for food policy. And we are looking forward to having a presentation on how the World Bank thinks that should look like.
Well, thank you very much. You know, this is exactly the time when we need this kind of interaction, because we have to start showing some success in agriculture, because the opportunity is right now. I just wanted to reinforce that the value in looking at the IASTD report and the report that Daniel and Sophie prepared. I think they're two of the most concise and worthwhile documents to look at in terms of understanding the challenges and the issues right now. Yesterday, I had planned not to do a presentation. And then I told that one of my colleagues that, and he said, well, if you're from the World Bank and you don't throw up a few graphs and charts, people will feel you didn't earn your lunch. So I'm afraid you're going to have to suffer with me through a few of those. But I'll move fairly quickly, because I think a lot of the topics I'll bring up are sort of illustrations of what others have raised. And I'll count on Leslie to help me manage the time here. I mean, we've heard about the changing context of food markets and the new opportunities. I mean, their high prices are a burden, but they're also obviously an opportunity for producers. The nature of demand is changing radically. It's moving away from the standard cereals, both in terms of what's consumed in developing countries as well as what developing countries are exporting. It's moving towards horticulture and meat products increasingly. As has been mentioned, the supply chains are increasingly integrated through supermarkets and other mechanisms. In some ways, that's a threat to agriculture, smallholder agriculture, because of the domination of some large food groups. But on the other hand, some of these supermarket groups are starting to see opportunities in what's often called bottom of the pyramid marketing, in terms of widening their client base to include some of the poorer groups. And also, there's increasing interest in ethnic foods worldwide that potentially are an opportunity for smallholders to supply. At the same time, we're seeing smallholder sourcing adding retail value very directly. Fair Trade and Starbucks, others are actually labeling and charging premium prices on the basis of working with smallholders. There's also increasing demand for environmental services, as was raised, from agriculture across a whole. And those are potentially some real opportunities for smallholder agriculture. And as has been mentioned, it's critical for climate change globally, of course, but in terms of the opportunities developing countries have to contribute to climate change mitigation. The major contributor in developing countries to greenhouse gases is essentially agriculture and deforestation associated with agriculture. Also, in a very exciting area, which was mentioned, is the democratization of information access. I mean, cell phones are appearing everywhere. They're getting into very remote rural areas. And the fastest growth in access to information, while it's starting from a low base, is in developing countries, is in Africa and other places. So this is an exciting movement. Now, one concept that we and others are working with is this idea of value chains and how smallholders fit into these value chains, because we've talked about the importance of the whole marketing chain in looking at agriculture, not just the production aspect. So why do we care about the smallholder sector? Well, I won't go into this in a lot of detail with this group, because I think but as been mentioned, they're an incredibly important group, both in terms of employment, those who are poor, if we want to address poverty, and as Daniel pointed out, agriculture is the most effective in most countries way of reducing poverty. What are empowering value chains? How do we define those? Well, it should allow smallholders to seize new opportunities. It should increase producer knowledge of the market demand and pricing. It should increase investments from farmers and other private sector participants. It should increase the access of smallholders to knowledge, finance, inputs, and technology. It should reduce the transaction costs in the producer, processor, marketing interface. And it should increase the share of value added captured by the primary producers, the smallholders. So some examples, I mean, what's important here, I won't go into the details, but these things are emerging in every region of the world, and that's what's exciting about it. It's not limited to East Asia or to Africa. I mean, everywhere in the world has started to develop these empowering value chains involving smallholders. So why aren't we seeing more of this? Well, a number of these constraints have been raised. I mean, one is the investment climate in many countries really limits the quantity and quality of agricultural investment. I mean, you know, one talks about deregulating. We can go back and forth on the issue of regulation, but we have to be very careful not to be dogmatic about regulation or reducing regulation or addressing regulation. If it takes you twice as long in a country to get a business license, and that's generally going to affect the smallholders, the small businesses more than the larger ones, you're at a disadvantage, both within your country and globally. So if you can address those regulatory issues, you do. The time to start a business, the days for export processing, you can see where the OECD is relative to these other countries, and it's quite a dramatic difference, and it puts smallholders in all businesses and local businesses in developing countries at a disadvantage. I just wanted to point out this also applies, interestingly, this morning we were talking about certification with some farmer groups from East Asia, and they were pointing out that the certification process in some of these countries is 10 to 20 times as expensive and takes many times longer for organic produce than it does in developed countries. So what a tremendous disincentive for smallholders to go in some of the directions we're talking about. So this is a regulatory issue that hasn't really been on the radar screen, but is very important. Marketing systems are inefficient. I mean, in many developing countries, you have a tremendous number of intermediaries, which, of course, increases costs, risks, and losses along the way. And has been raised before, a very fundamental issue is property rights. When prices went up, I mean, the studies have shown pretty generally that in those countries that had reasonably equitable land distributions and reasonably secure tenure, there was generally a positive poverty impact. But in those places with tremendous inequalities in land distribution or poor tenure rights, generally the opposite was seen. And, of course, there's been mentioned the limited access to finance, and these are just some examples of how those with less constrained finance tend to do better. And it's been raised, and we certainly agree, there's been a tremendous underinvestment in agriculture and rural infrastructure in terms of public investment in particular. But at the same time, we have to focus on the quality of investment. A lot of the investment that was reduced was not necessarily – it was reduced because it was not producing the results it was intended to. It was being captured, whether it was subsidized credit being captured by elites, whether it was marketing boards that were essentially the money wasn't going to the farmers. Often the producer prices were lower than in neighboring countries that didn't have marketing boards. And you had tremendous illegal flows across borders to other countries. But there is an issue of that doesn't mean you walk away from agricultural investment. You find better agricultural investment. And there's been some good studies by IFPRI, which is represented here, and others, that you know things like agricultural research and development, irrigation, education, roads, these things are high payoff investments that deserve much more attention. And then, as been mentioned, there's been a tremendous move towards concentration in the agribusiness sector. This is showing the market shares, the C4 concentration ratios in the key areas of agrochemicals, seeds, and biotech, and how that's increased. We're seeing the claim on value-added, developing countries' claim on value-added in agriculture declining from 60% in 1970-72 down to 28% in 1998 to 2000. And this is in the World Development Report in 2008. So these are huge trends. So in terms of a way forward, recognizing the potential upside of these value chains and at the same time recognizing the constraints, well, clearly a need for strengthening the legal frameworks to build trust and reduce the cost of transactions in countries. Addressing these general business climate issues of licensing and trade facilitation, strengthening land access and tenure security cannot be emphasized enough. Developing better rural finance systems and risk services so smallholders have access to those services. obviously efficient input markets so that smallholders can get access to the fertilizer, the seeds, the knowledge that they need. Rural infrastructure improvement, again, very large payoffs in most developing countries. And then the whole issue of quality and sanitary and phytosanitary standards to help to make those work for the smallholder and helping smallholders to be able to meet those standards. And then broader market information, and very fundamentally, strengthening producer organizations in order to help farmers engage in the market on less skewed terms. I won't go into this, but I mean, this basically what this demands is a new role of the state, and we've talked about some of those elements. And, you know, there's some real drivers to this, so it's not just a theoretical idea. I mean, these are the drivers that are out there in the world today. There's a dynamic that results from that, and there are some roles. And it's basically pushing the state to get out of direct provision and into really providing the right basis for smallholders and farmer organizations to take more authority, to give them more voice in the political and fiscal realms of countries, and to strengthen the coordination mechanisms of the institutions that work with agriculture and smallholders. Similarly, there's tremendous dynamics driving the role of the private sector, many of them hopeful, much more diversification of product sourcing to deal with political risks and others. This, as I mentioned, the branding of smallholders as a way of getting more value in the market, so therefore more interest in sourcing from smallholders, more interest in traditional varieties as there's more interest from consumers in different food habits around the world, and you know, much more working directly with farmers to provide them with the tools to be able to produce so that they can sell it effectively into their markets. But again, farmer associations are absolutely critical. And again, here are a number of examples of where this has worked, how it's taken conflictive situations in a country like Tanzania, where there was basically almost armed conflict between farmers and a local miller, and how it was turned around into a sort of what we call a win-win situation, where the farmers are doing much better, the millers are doing better, and it's doable. And now it's looking like it's expanding, and the government is now becoming a key facilitator in that process. But an important caveat is that many smallholders won't be able to integrate in this approach. This is not the magic bullet. This is one part of the solution. There are areas that are constrained agronomically because of low rainfall to be able to produce the kind of products that would fit into these value chains. Sometimes they're constrained by market access. Sometimes there's a need for and that raises need for rural roads, irrigation, and other food security measures. I mean, we can't forget the fundamental importance of safety nets in rural as well as urban areas for those who simply won't be able to integrate rapidly into these new opportunities. And, of course, there need to be investments in education and health and active labor market policies, because not everyone's going to want to stay in agriculture. It may not be
Al Milliken, American Independent Writers. What is known about the nutritional value of the food available to the developing world? Is it comparable to that available to the developed world when considering its vitamin and mineral content, as well as the ways food quality is compromised with pesticides, chemicals, and antibiotics? There was a mention of cheap food. Does this relate to quality and nutritional value as well as quantity and price?
Next question, please.
Ken Dillon, Scientia Press. Biofuel technology is a moving target, and when we get in 10, 15, 20 years to third and fourth generation biofuels that could be very profitable, there will be a high incentive for farmers throughout the world to grow biofuel crops. How do we ensure that there's protection of the poor and hungry of the world? Are taxes enough, or are we going to have to find other measures?
Thank you. Please, the lady over there.
My name is Asmita. I'm with the Rural Coalition. And I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali for the last year. And in Mali, we waited for the food riots of Senegal and Dakar to hit Bamako and to the city that I lived in the Sahara. And it wasn't really a factor. It didn't really occur in that country the way it did in the rest of Africa. And it seemed to me a product of the fact that Mali's agriculture is local, self-sufficient, and primarily independent. And so I wonder how much of the international community's role in providing self-sufficient local markets for food should be our willingness to bow out and stop providing as much advice as we have done in the past.
Okay. And the fourth question?
My name is Julie Howard from the Partnership to Cut Hunger and Poverty in Africa, and thanks to the Carnegie Endowment for this focus, need to focus on agriculture. I wanted to ask the panelists to be a little bit more specific about how they see the government's new role in agriculture. And I wanted especially to ask how you view that in light of the evidence that we have from the 70s and 80s, particularly in Africa, where there was a very heavy hand of government in agriculture, doing some of the same things that it seems to me you're recommending today. For example, global or grain stocks, national grain stocks, and also setting prices. And there was not a very good experience with that. And then we look at the experience with India on one hand and with Zambia on the other, where quite a lot of the agricultural budgets is going for subsidies in one hand or the other. How do you view the role of government? And in India and Zambia, it's quite an opportunity cost trade-off. You know, you're spending a lot on grain stocks or subsidies. That means you don't have a lot to spend on rural infrastructure. So how are we to think about those trade-offs?
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Maybe, Steve, you can start with the question on the nutritional value of food and the differences, since that was one of the issues. It seems that the IAASTD report picked up upon.
There was an involvement of a number of public health professionals who looked at the nutritional issue, and as I said, there is a great deal of underinvestment in ensuring that there are marketing channels and support for not only fruits and vegetables, but also indigenous grains, the so-called orphan crops that don't get any support. I mean, traditionally support goes to wheat, maize, and rice, and not to teff and quinoa, to say nothing of vegetables and fruits. And so that failure of investment combined with a lot of indirect subsidies for highly refined sugars, for example, high fructose corn syrup, and for fats and empty calories, has led to both an undernutrition crisis and a chronic disease crisis that is related to deficient nutrition. So there's a number of proposals. Some of them are related to the WHO project on diet-related chronic disease. I did not work on that particular part of the chapter, so I can't give it to you in great detail. But I do know that this is definitely something that has the interest of governments, if only because of the huge social and economic costs of diet-related disease, to say nothing of the loss of cognitive development and loss of labor power due to undernutrition.
And Steve wanted to get in on that specifically.
Yeah, no, I think, you know, we're cognizant of, but I'm not sure if we're doing enough on the nutrition aspect of the food crisis. I think this is, you know, there's tremendous we're hearing about it, and we're trying now, for instance, in the World Bank support to ensure that every single proposal that comes to us at least is looked at to see is there an opportunity to address nutritional dimensions, not just food availability aspects. As part of the response, because what is happening is people are one of the consequences of the high prices. People are going to lower quality foods, and lower nutritional value. And as was pointed out, I mean, this is particularly of concern for the sort of under 2-year-old groups in the world. And this would be a tremendous long term consequence, tragedy that would come out of this food crisis to affect sort of the development of young children.
Thank you. We had the question on biofuel technologies and how to ensure with them moving forward that there is protection for the poor and basically to guarantee food safety and food sovereignty. Daniel and both Daniel and Sandra to that?
I think that one thing that we have to look right now, for instance, is that the commodity prices, agricultural commodity prices today are roughly 60% of what they were at their peak. So we are already in the way down. And in my opinion, we need biofuels in order to increase the competition with land use in order to keep prices at reasonable levels. Don't ask me right now what is a reasonable level, though, but that's what we need for. Okay. At the same time, what biofuels presents is a huge challenge because the demand for energy compared to food is basically unlimited. So we cannot let just the free market by itself determine how much biofuels we are going to produce. So I think that the expansion and the use of biofuels is has to be directly regulated, especially by the big consumers. One of the things that we have to understand is that biofuels are not cheap. So what we see right now is that the EU and the US are paying for the use of biofuels and has been responsible to an extent to generate these prices. And I think that in the near future, that's one element that could keep prices high or higher than we have seen in the last 30 years.
Anybody else on the biofuel? If not, I would go on to the next part of the question, government's new role in agriculture. Sandra, you wanted to go in on that?
And I think it also reflects on the comment that was made about the experience in Mali during the real height of the food crisis and the fact that Mali didn't have demonstrations. They have largely self-sufficient agriculture. Not all countries can be self-sufficient in agriculture. They may be land-constrained, water-constrained, whatever. However, I think that we can say that the bottom line is that the new role of government in agriculture is to have a strategy for food security for its people. This is probably the most fundamental responsibility of government going back to when we first began using tools, is that the government organizes society so that the basic needs are met in a way which is done better than by individuals themselves. So, depending on the endowment of a particular country in terms of land, in terms of water, in terms of labor force, any good government which is responsive to its population is going to have a strategy for food security. Many governments have not had that. The riots impressed that on governments who weren't paying attention, but I was at a conference last month with a number of senior officials from African governments, and it certainly has awakened the attention of all governments that they have to worry about food security. Now, what tools will they use? It's true that there was a time when governments in developing countries were much more involved in their agricultural markets. It's also true that governments in developed countries continue to be very involved in their agricultural markets, whether it's the U.S., France, or any of the other European countries, Japan, et cetera. Most governments are very involved in their agricultural markets. There are a lot of tools, whether those tools involve grain stocks in terms of a minimum food security requirement, intervention in price markets, guaranteeing minimum prices. Those tools can be used well or they can be used poorly. For every example we have of a country that used their price-setting policies poorly and it was distorted and captured by elites, we can find other examples of countries that used price-setting policies that kept the smallholders from going under. And so what we have to look at is not the good example, the bad example. We have to look at each of those tools and say, in a particular situation, in a particular country, which of those tools will be appropriate and how can we build it, how can we use it in a way that will put in safeguards so that it doesn't become misused. I use the example of India, and one can point to the minimum price support in India as an extremely successful tool that they have used to mitigate the impacts of the food crisis. At the same time, India's across-the-board subsidies for fuel and some other inputs has been badly targeted, and it has been captured in many cases, not by the people it was intended for, but by others. Those are two separate policies. Fuel subsidies and minimum price supports are two policies. We can't lump them together. We have to examine each one of these individual tools that have been tried and tested over decades and generations in different countries, find the ones that are appropriate, and not refrain from using them because it's the government using it rather than the private sector. The private sector failed in this food crisis. We have to say that. That doesn't mean that the private sector has no role to play in this, but we have to say the idea that if government gets out of the way in agriculture in developing countries, that the private sector will come in that failed. That failed, and that caused hunger, and that caused riots. So that can't be our mantra. The mantra has to be, what does government need to do because no one else will do it? What can the private sector be relied on to do because there's an incentive for them to do it? And how do you balance, and how do you use those tools, chisel those tools, if you will, to be very appropriate ones and to use them appropriately in the context? I think that's the question that we have to ask, and that's how we find the answer of what is the role of government.
Great. Thank you, Davo.
I will take some example from Benin, where I come from. And when there was a food crisis, the government was forced to intervene to reduce the taxes to help to keep the cost of food very low. But what happened? People started to export the food to the other countries where those kind of mechanisms do not exist. And then the government was obliged to intervene. And also, we found that the main issue is related to the storage of grain, because there is a lot of loss. And what the government is doing now is to buy the crop, the maize mainly, and to keep it, and to bring it into the market when the price is going up, and that helps to reduce, to decrease the price of the food. And also what I am experimenting now is that the government, because of food crisis, is trying to invest more in agriculture than before. Now we can see many government investing in equipment for the farmers and helping them to buy those equipment at cheaper price. Then, and also the government encourage private people who are willing to promote agriculture. For example, in my country, there is a very big entrepreneur who is not in agriculture, but he is promoting nowadays rice, because we have been shortage of rice, and now people are developing rice in everywhere in the country, as there is a variety which can be grown everywhere in all the soil, the rice called Nerika in the country. Thank you.
We have one short comment on the same issue from Steve from the World Bank, and obviously the World Bank is working with governments, so they might have some ideas on what role the government should provide.
What might be some roles. But I think this sort of goes to the two questions, one about from the experience in Mali as well as the role of the government. And I think the two come together in our view and in our experience in making sure that whatever investments governments make respond to what the local communities themselves prioritize. And I think that's what was in many cases missing in the 80s, let's say, when a lot of it was very top-down, saying this is what the farmers there need, which may or may not have met their needs. And was often politically motivated, to the extent that the way now that governments are working with agriculture really relies on communities planning and identifying their priority needs, and farmer organizations indicating what's most important for them, then we have that's where the best opportunity is to ensure that governments are getting it more right than before. And I fully agree with Sandra. I mean, we have to move all of us from dogmatism to pragmatism. I mean, what works, what works where, and where it works, understand why, and then work with countries, governments, and non-governmental organizations across the board, farmers' organizations, the private sector, to see what works in a specific country in a specific circumstance. Thanks. Okay.
We have about 12 minutes left. So if there are, can I have a show of hand if there are some more questions that need to be? Well, I'll take, I would say, three more. Please be brief so that we can allow answer. Pardon? Oh, sorry, in the interest of time, one question here, one question, the lady here, and the gentleman here. Go ahead, please.
Yes, my name is Judith Poyt, and I'm with the Agribusiness Accountability Initiative. And all of you have at least mentioned or alluded to the detrimental effects of concentration in the agribusiness sector as far as fertilizers, seed, et cetera. That coupled with the influence that these corporations, the agribusiness corporations, have on trade agreements, multilateral and bilateral trade agreements, and the revolving door between private sector and government. If you had to choose, and I would like to address this to Sandra, but welcome other thoughts. If you had to choose one or two global actions that would help turn the tide with these agribusiness companies, what would they be? Thank you.
Okay. Someone here.
Hi, my name is Talia. I'm representing the UNFAO. The question for the World Bank is how the World Bank is working with the U.S. regarding the subsidies in South American countries. And because I understand that the World Bank would work with governments, but there's always a conflict in trying to understand each other's government. And the second question is concerning the groundwater. I understand Sandra points out that certain things have to be separated in order to study them individually, but I would like to see more of the agriculture get, making a more specifics with water, because water is the main point of agriculture, and because of that, of course, the conflicts arise in the Middle East and in Africa. So if we would save some money looking at that part of the issue, and then, of course, with agricultural.
Great. Thank you. And the last question, then.
My name is Steve Bresch with World Neighbors, an NGO. One question was going to be on the issue of corporate concentration, about how can that be addressed to make this common agenda you're describing move forward. And the second is on what role NGOs can play in supporting farmers associations and local national governments to make this agenda a reality.
Great. Thank you. Maybe we can start with the question of the corporate concentration. Sandra, I don't know whether you have anything, but I would encourage the rest of the panel to butt in on that one as well.
Yes, two of the questions got to the issue of concentration, and I think the specific question was that makes for some very powerful political actors who are able to influence their country's trade policy. Certainly that's true of my country and many others as well. And what two things can we do? There, I would say that there is one issue which is fundamentally important that hopefully a new administration will take up vis-a-vis trade negotiations, and that is that the Doha round, and this could apply to bilateral trade agreements as well, the Doha round started out as an agreement that was supposed to be oriented toward developing countries, an agreement that would make the global trading regime more friendly toward development, more friendly toward poverty alleviation. At the end, when the talks broke down in July, and as I said earlier, they probably won't get going again now until we have a new administration here and possibly one in some of the other countries. When they broke down, the U.S. was taking the position that it was about market access, and it was about market access for U.S. farmers to export their goods, primarily about exporting them into China and India. That was what the U.S. said the Doha round was about. The countries that were resisting that, including China and India and the so-called G33 group of countries that have serious problems in agriculture, were saying, no, this is a round about development. Agriculture is where our poor people are. Agriculture is how we grow out of development. This has to be about giving us the tools or leaving the tools in our hands, not taking them away, that allow us to have this investment in agriculture, both by individual subsistence farmers, by investors, by the private sector, by government. We need to be able to maintain these tools so that there are incentives to go into agriculture so that we can follow the path that other countries fell. That contrast between whether this is about market access for U.S. exporters and other agribusiness exporters, or is it about development, that's the thing we have to change if we want the trade regime to work. The trade regime is not the only policy issue here by any means, as all of my colleagues on this panel have pointed out, but I think that's the one thing that we do have to change.
Yes, thank you. Steve, you want to come in?
Yes. One of the things that's lacking in the on the multilateral regime are any disciplines against anti-competitive business practices. The reason that corporate concentration is of interest to people who would like to actually see a really functioning agricultural market is because corporate concentration tends to be highly correlated with anti-competitive business behavior. If you read, you know, classics in this issue like James Lieber's Rats in the Grain, you get a small insight into the extent of that lack of enforcement of the law. Back in 2001, the European Union's competition policy director, Mario Monti, who was instrumental in breaking up the mafia in Italy, proposed that there be these kind of anti-competitive business disciplines. The United States was very strongly opposed. They wouldn't even talk about guidelines at the OECD. I think this is a subject that is ripe, really, for multilateral negotiation. The other issue here, I think, that I want to get a little bit on the commodities index fund issue is that right now you have a situation in which the financial services industry is basically running not only farmers into the ground, but even agribusiness, especially the smaller ones who don't have the intelligence capabilities to take advantage of these very tight supplies that are very vulnerable to betting on price movements, which is what is done through these commodities index funds, especially those that are traded through Standard & Poor's, Goldman Sachs, which is the largest entity, and then Dow Jones AIG, which is the second largest entity, and it's no surprise that the government chose to save those two firms rather than saving some other firms. So I think there are definitely things that can be done. There are plenty of policy instruments that are out there. They've been suggested in the Commodities Futures Trading Commission. The Inspector General of the United States in January of 2006 indicated that both the Justice Department and the U.S. Department of Agriculture had ceased to enforce the law concerning anti-competitive business practices. But there is really a need in a global market for some multilateral disciplines.
Okay, wonderful. We have two more questions, or did any one of you go specifically on that question that I hope we can address? One was the question particularly focusing on the issue of water, and that I guess relates very much to the type of agriculture that we will use going forward. As we heard, there are differences in the way of agriculture, how energy intensive, how much dependent on irrigation it is, and, you know, for example, a focus on export-oriented agriculture might not be the best idea in very water-poor areas. Maybe one of you want to get on that, Davo or Daniel?
I'm afraid of water. Water is an issue that we or people keep talking, and still there is not enough conscience about the issue, one of quality, but most importantly of quantity. However, one of the things that we haven't done in the last 15 to 20 years is to direct investment towards practices and or seeds or crops that make a much more efficient use of water. And I think that should be or must be one of the elements of the next generation, if you wish, of agricultural research priorities that have to be put forward. For the last 25 years, we have been very efficient at converting tons of fossil fuels into high yields. And because of that, we have made huge strides in agricultural productivity. Well, agricultural productivity, which is important to feed the population, is not the only variable now that needs to be taken into account in this new generation. And I think that water is one of the elements that have to be prioritized together with practices that reduce greenhouse gases, practices that regenerate and make use of natural fertilizers and regenerate soils. And I think that all of those elements have to be key. But what we cannot do is, I think, try to undermine the development of specific industries or crops just because water in general is an issue. Water is a very local issue. And because it's a very local issue, has to be addressed within the reality of that particular region.
Okay. Steve on that quickly.
The IASTD has an analysis of this situation and has, you know, suggested that policy options for supporting dry land agriculture really need to be invested in a lot more than they have been. Farmers in dry lands have known how to farm and farm well without irrigation. For a long time, and unfortunately, a lot of the projects, the big investments, for example, the Gates Foundation project in Kenya, are going directly to the best land, to the best irrigation, rather than going to where the farmers are. So I think there's a lot to be learned from traditional knowledge about agriculture, not only for crops, but also for livestock and preserving and supporting livestock biodiversity, which is even more endangered than plant biodiversity.
Okay, wonderful. And when we have the one last question, and I would just ask or give each of our panelists a quick opportunity to put in their 5 cents, 10 cents words of thought on what role NGOs, the civil society, can or should play, particularly in supporting and strengthening small-scale farmers, but also in helping governments in that supporting functions. I don't know. It would be fair, Davo, maybe we'll start with you and work our way through.
No, I think that it is well known that the government concentrated in how to get foreign funds. Small-scale farmers are most of the time ignored, and NGOs can play a very good role in helping those small-scale farmers to grow and to be efficient. And with respect to the Farmers Association, government like to have just organization created, but do not care too much about how those organizations function. And I think that it is the role of the NGOs to help those organizations to function well and to bring benefit to all members, not only to a few members in the committees. And I think that NGOs have a big role to play in that because they are more in the area than the government. That's what I would like to say.
Okay. Steve?
In the trade environment and agricultural policy process, usually firms, and especially representatives of transnational corporations, usually have better access and more influence in policy formulation and policy implementation. I think that in order to have sustainable development, have equitable development, there's going to have to be a lot more actors who actually have policy influence and access in this process, especially among those NGOs which are responsible for program implementation delivery. I would particularly point out that there's a real need to empower women farmers associations who are often told by their governments in developing countries, we can't do anything because the WTO won't let us, which is not necessarily so. And so I think that there are a number of roles that can be played, but the policy formulation process has to change because the current lockout and let's get behind closed doors and cut another deal is not going anywhere. The club is over.
Obviously, there are NGOs and NGOs the same way that there are governments and governments. So you may as well you may know that better than I do. But I think that one of the key roles have to be a whole agents, economic and political agents, accountable and ensure or fight for a transparency of the process. I think that one of the obstacles for NGOs is that usually they are mission-driven, and sometimes the mission is very specific. And sometimes that mission is so specific that gets in the way of reaching practical or pragmatical solutions. So there is also a need for open up a dialogue among the agents, political agents and NGOs, in order to permeate both sides of what are the actions, the alternatives, the conditions under which specific programs, policies, or decisions are being made and considered.
Thank you. Sandra.
I would pick up on a point that Steve Schoenberger emphasized in his presentation and that Steve Supan just made, which is a point for NGOs and for these groups themselves. Organize farmers, organize poor farmers, organize rural communities, organize, organize, organize. There is such asymmetry of bargaining power in these agricultural food chains that if the small producers, if the poor don't get organized, there really isn't going to be a lot of hope. Even if governments set the proper rules of the game, those groups have to get organized as well. And so the emphasis that NGOs in country can put on helping that kind of organization, international NGOs should be supportive of groups that organize themselves and try to facilitate. But I think that the organizing of their political power and their bargaining power in market relationships is extremely important.
It's kind of hard for someone from the World Bank to sort of be in a good position to say to NGOs what you should be doing. But maybe what I'll do is what some things we've seen that seem to work is maybe a better way of putting it. Some things that and others have hit it just right on the money. I mean, one is obviously the raising awareness and bringing transparency to processes both in the multilateral discussions at the developed country level, at the lower income country level. I mean, how do you let people make sure people are aware of the issues and make sure there's transparency about what's really going on out there? A second one, which I think is very, very important, is innovation. We've seen tremendous innovation come out of NGO-supported initiatives that you just don't see coming out of bilateral or multilateral development agencies. I mean, we're a bit cumbersome. We have to be a little bit conservative. There's a lot of money at stake, and we can, you know, we try and be innovative, but there's tremendous scope for NGOs, whether they're NGOs in developing countries or NGOs from what richer countries working in local areas to really innovate and scale up and bring those things to our attention. We had the development marketplace last week at the World Bank, and it was so exciting, the kind of things. I mean, it was just amazing what came from NGOs from all over the world, and there are things that we're really excited about trying to see, can some of those things be scaled up now, and can we bring those things to the attention of government and others? So that's huge. And then the last one, again, as Sandra said, you know, the farmer organization, and one way where we've seen that seems to be particularly successful is when NGOs facilitate communication amongst farmer organizations. I mean, it's called South-South, but it's not necessarily that's the right way to say it. But that, you know, farmer organizations in one country or farmers in one country can see what their counterparts in other countries are doing, and that gives them both sort of more courage, if you wish, and more excitement about what's possible. And we've seen that to be a very, very effective way that NGOs can really facilitate developing more strength amongst farmer organizations.